That is up to Genesis. We have quite a bit to cover, and we need to get into the 11th chapter in the first verse, and I have not forgotten the 10th chapter, but this is what we're going to do. We are going to study the 11th chapter and verses 1 through 9 first, because I believe that this event, the Tower of Babel and the confounding of the languages, chronologically precedes the 10th chapter. For the 10th chapter, which has been called commonly the Table of the Nations, is an explanation of how the nations divided themselves subsequent to the confounding of the languages. And the Table of the Nations gives us how that the various family groups went off into their own geographical areas, and how the world then came to be in terms of population distribution when by the time of Abraham. And you need to remember this as well, that we're not given in Genesis some kind of an ancient history. It's correct on ancient history, but it's not an ancient history textbook as such. That every once in a while, you'd like an extra chapter, wouldn't you? I would. There are places I'd like extra chapters. I'd like a little more explanation here and there. But the Bible is not designed to give us simply a source book to satisfy our curiosity, either about history or any other thing. We're given all that we need to know. Now, this little thing right here that I'm about to say will help you to appreciate why we have in the 10th chapter the statement of the Table of the Nations. Then we come to the 11th chapter, and then at verse 10, we come back to another genealogy in chapter 11, verse 10. Because it's like this. Who is the subject? If you go back to the 9th chapter with a pronouncement of a curse on Canaan and a blessing on Shem and a word about the enlargement of Japheth, you come back and Shem is dealt with last among the three. Then, after we get to Shem, that is in chapter 10, when we come on into Shem and how his family tree breaks off, then you have in the middle here Tower of Babel. Then we come back to what? Shem. So Shem's important. Shem's important in the 10th and 11th chapters. And in a sense, the other things are kind of incidental to that. Though we probably, I guess if we'd been asked this question sometime or a year or so ago, we might have said, what's the most important thing you can think of in Genesis 10 and 11? We said, Tower of Babel. Well, Tower of Babel, the incident, is given simply to explain how the nations became distributed. But that's incidental to the fact that here is Shem. And we're going to narrow it on down through Shem and come to see one of the descendants of Shem and then one of his descendants. And finally, it's all going to come right on down to one person by the name of Abraham. And then we'll be occupied with just one family. So you see something there forming, don't you? That we're coming down from Genesis 3:15, taking us as that prophecy of the coming of the one who will bruise the head of the serpent, and this, that which the woman will give birth to, ultimately the Redeemer. What this writer is doing is tracing on down how that this Messiah will come, and we get more specific information as we go along. Now, there's some other reasons, too. I don't want to oversimplify it, because Moses is writing Genesis at a time in Israel's history where there are some special needs, and he records some of these events for some very special purposes. I'll show you that in a minute when we get to the 10th chapter. But we're starting in chapter 11, in verse 1, with this explanation of the Tower of Babel incident. The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. The literal reading of this in the Hebrew is one lip and one word. It could very well then be that the idea is this. They used the same language and they all had the same vocabulary. They had the same thought patterns. As I'll show you in a minute, when God changed the languages, he probably also at that time changed the thought patterns. You know, there's more to language differences than just words. There are thought patterns in which people, in which they think, and how they put their their syntax together and their, well, I'll show you a little later on, but this is the idea. The whole earth was of one lip, same language, same words, same vocabulary. And it came about, or it came to pass, as they journeyed east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. Let's look at this map to get an idea of how they're moving and what's happening. This map doesn't give some of the detail that could help us, but here, maybe if this might help if you're thinking modern-day geographical boundaries. This is modern-day Turkey, Asia Minor, or in the ancient world called Anatolia. This we have up in here, Russia, southern Russia, the Caucasus Mountains. We have Iraq, Iran. We have Syria. You're down here, Saudi Arabia. But sitting right up here, here's where the border of Turkey is. Here's the border in the Soviet Union. Sitting just inside of the Turkish border today, the mountain of Ararat, the mountains of Ararat run in this area on the border of Turkey and Russia. So they're moving out of this area. This is where the ark settled, somewhere on the mountains of Ararat. They move down in the direction of this very fertile plain, what we have known in our textbooks as the cradle of civilization. Now, don't be disturbed by so-called discoveries in Africa by the Leakeys and by discoveries, where is it, in Burma now, by other anthropologists, and one is laying claim to this place as being the center of civilization and another. The scripture is quite clear that the cradle of civilization is this part of the world. And this is the area into which they moved. And it so impressed them that they had memories by word of mouth around campfires. They had memories, and Noah and his sons told them about the days before the flood, which had been brought to them about the original garden. And they even named the rivers, at least one of the rivers, they named the Euphrates, this river after the original river that flowed through the Garden of Eden. So they came into this area and they lived, a very fertile plain, and it had a lot of promise. So this is the reference in verse 2. They found the plain and they settled there. Babylon, we're going to see, lies down here to the southeast of Ararat, and about where the point of the pin is. Verse 3. Now we have the first urban enterprise, the first attempt at urbanization. And they said to one another, come. The imperative here maybe could be translated something like, come on. They sat down at some council. Now, from what the 10th chapter said, and if we'd gone through the 10th chapter first, we could have been helped, I guess, by bringing into the picture a man by the name of Nimrod, though we will get him a little later. Nimrod seems to have been an organizer here. If I may use the well-worn term to describe him, a rather charismatic kind of person. He had a lot of charisma. Back in the 10th chapter, he's called a mighty hunter. That doesn't mean that he was outstanding in Field and Stream magazine or the Sportsman of the Year. I think it's to be understood as he was a tyrant. He was that kind of hunter of men. And I think that he is the organizer, and he's got a plan. And they work it out in this way. They're going to use the building material that's at their fingertips. Let us make brick, burn them thoroughly. And they had brick, they used brick for stone. Now the American Standard and the King James use the word slime. That's not a good translation. It wasn't slime. I don't know what you think about when you think about slime, but I don't think about a very good mortar base when I think of slime. This is the word in the Hebrew. Well, let's look at it and let's take it from there. The Hebrew word translated slime here is the word hamar. Looks like this. Comes out something like this in English, C-H-E-M-A-R, hamar. A verb means to boil up. to bubble up. One translation, therefore, has used the word tar. The Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of this Old Testament, has used the word asphaltos. Does that sound like a word? Asphalt. It is or bitumen, or an asphalt, and this is what they used to seal the joints. It was a cement substitute. So this is what they used to join the sun-dried bricks, not sun-dried bricks, but they used these fire-dried bricks. You say, so what? For this reason, and it's something you could easily miss in this third verse. Special attention is called in this third verse to the very special efforts they took to make this place. I mean, this isn't some kind of... these people aren't sort of shuffling along out through the plain of Shinar, sort of half ape, half man, shuffling along and then decide to make a mud house. Let's pack this together and let's build something. But we have a group of very intelligent people. And the modern man, he thinks well of himself, and evolution has made modern man to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. And evolution has also made us to think that ancient man is not quite as smart as we are. But actually the reverse is true. Ancient man was smarter than we are. We still haven't figured out a lot of the things that he's done and how he came upon certain concepts and construction procedures. Well, what I'm saying is that it was a group of highly intelligent people, but unfortunately, they all carried sin natures, and they had a leader who was a mighty hunter, a tyrant named Nimrod, and had an organizational meeting, and they're going to build a city that won't quit. And they are sitting down for a project to have an urbanization like you wouldn't believe. Why would we think them doing anything less than somebody would build a great city like New York or Chicago or Atlanta? They had great objectives in mind. And the special attention is called to that. This was not just sun-dried brick. See, sun-dried brick would not have the permanency as fire-dried brick. And they're using something to seal the joints that even is going to create some greater structural stability. So this is not, in other words, an average structure. Well, let's go a little further. They add slime or add tar. It's bitumen for mortar. Verse 4, they said, now, you say anything wrong with building the city? We have the old phrase, God made the country and man made the city. Well, wait a minute. That's true and it's not true. I was talking with someone lately about cities, and they always seem to become kind of a cesspool for crime and wickedness. It's not because of the inherent evil of a city, because after all, God will get the last laugh on that in the New Jerusalem. I mean, that'll be a city that won't quit. The problem with the city is not the concept of the city, it's the fact that you concentrate sin natures into a given area. And when you concentrate sin natures into a limited area, naturally you're going to have to start surrendering some freedoms. You don't have the independence otherwise that you would out in a rural area. And by concentrating people in an area like that, and what seems to usually happen is that problems of work and economic factors enter in, you're going to create a great deal of centralized power. In order to control this maximum number of people in a limited area, you go to centralization of government. And with centralization of government, you come down to a nice device for the sin nature to go wild, usually in a tyrant, a dictator, corruption, crime. Now, verse 4 indicates that the problem is not in the city, but it's in the motive behind the city, or shall we say the leadership. They said, come, let us build a city. Now, there are about three statements here that we ought to analyze very carefully. One is that the idea of a city. Let us build for ourselves a city, a very carefully planned urban center. Now, this isn't, I would suggest, probably even better than a lot of our own modern city builders have done, whereas many of our modern cities have been, what? They just happened over a period of years. and it's just grown out into a great big cumbersome metropolis with no rhyme or reason many times for the streets, how they're laid out, and how to get from one point to the next. But I don't think this is what's involved. They're planning this thing from beginning to end. And secondly, he says they're going to build a tower. This tower is quite important in the total urban project because it seems to become the focal point of everything. And this tower is said whose top to heaven. Now, it says in the King James, whose top may reach. Now, so I guess a rather superficial understanding of that may lead one to think that they're trying to work their way up to God and go into heaven. Did you ever hear that? I picked that up somewhere. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be too hard on such a view like that. Maybe it was just somebody who just made some preposterous statements, and I've thought about it frequently. But they're not trying to get to heaven. This is to give them credit for more sense. Their top, the top to heaven means a top representative of heaven. They apparently are making here a temple with some religious significance associated with it. Because we have, not the original, but we have imitations of this original tower have been excavated, they've been discovered, and we've learned something about their significance. These were temple towers. Well, I'm going to talk more about that in a minute, but let me just define the text for you now, and then I'll come back to this in a minute. So this is a temple tower. Our archaeologists have uncovered some of these, the remnants of such. They're called ziggurats, whose top may reach, or whose top to the heavens. And let us make us a name. They want a reputation. So here's their motive. They want to set up a memorial, and the idea is this is an expression of pride as well as rebellion. Rebellion against what? Well, you'll see in the next phrase. It says, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. God's command had been to get out of the ark and to do what? Scatter. Go. God had authorized what I may gather under the term the principle of nationalism. That there should be population distribution over the face of the earth in given areas with governments over those people in those special geographical areas. Nationalism. Groups of people governing themselves. Not all people being governed by one central government. So they're working contrary to the command of God. They want to stay. They figure, I guess, that there is safety in numbers. Possibly they're thinking of that protection against another flood, though God had already promised them that there wouldn't be a judgment like that again. I think there were some religious motives that went awry, and I'll show you how it could very well have worked. But this is what they're doing. They are in rebellion. They were in pride. Nimrod is a tyrant. He's organizing the people under a centralized government for a great urban center. And out of this develops a false religious system. Now let's stop and talk about this tower they've built. We have some discoveries which have helped us. I'm going to use a couple of diagrams on this. First of all, let's use this one, and it'll help us from the archaeological standpoint. The ziggurat ruins today look like this. So if you and I were to travel over there, we wouldn't see a lot that would impress us. It looks like maybe an old building that's come in for some disrepair and fallen in and top of it. That's exactly what happened, is that the shifting sands, the erosion has worn this down. But we can put some things together. And so we get this picture. Here's the ziggurat. There are about, I think, around 30 of these that have been discovered. And, I guess the part of the world would be Iran, in that area, in this area around the Tigris-Euphrates river basin. These have been uncovered. Now, this is not the original tower is not in existence. Some think that there are remnants of it. I think probably it has been partially destroyed and then built on and destroyed and built on. It could very well be one of two places, But that doesn't concern us. The point is that these, I think, are patterned after the original prototype. The prototype was the tower. And these subsequent towers were attempts by people in that part of the world to reconstruct this original. It's an interesting study. I haven't gone into it in any details. To think of the attempts of men elsewhere to construct towers, temple towers. Wasn't the Incas, the Mayas, have done the same thing? Not the mere height so much as a place to which they may ascend and make their human sacrifices. In this temple tower complex, you have this layer cake effect. And the ones that have been discovered by archaeologists, one has been discovered with a base of 150 feet wide, 200 feet long, and 70 feet in height. Now, it could very well, I think probably the original temple tower was much larger than this, but this is one that has been excavated. And at the top, they had what was, well, sort of a mini temple, a little temple. And it was enameled inside in blue. It was representative of heaven. And what they did in subsequent Babylonian religion and history, now I'm trying to walk a careful line here, I don't want to confuse you. I don't want to confuse the original towers, subsequent towers. I think subsequent towers probably had represented a more developed kind of religious system than maybe there was originally. But this is what I think happened even originally. The top with this temple tower represented heaven, and it was probably the beginning or the attempt of man to have an aid to worship. An aid to worship. But this eventually came along the lines of Romans 1, 21 through 23, from worshiping the Creator to worshiping the creature to perhaps trying to find some aids to worship. And then in the process, then, this temple top became an actual place for sacrifice, eventually even human sacrifice, and a place where in later Babylonian religion, Marduk was worshipped. Some suggest that this may be even an attempt to reconstruct a worship around the ancient tyrant Nimrod, who became quite a legend in subsequent history, as well as his wife Semiramis. So this temple top then became a place of religious significance. So they're not building a tower just to kind of look out over the countryside, drop a dime in, go through the turnstile, and look down and see the Persian Gulf or something, see seven states, or like Lookout Mountain, see Rock City, that kind of thing. There's more to it than that. Maybe this other picture of one would help, a little dramatize a little more. Because this one's got a little color to it, and here we are. Must have been a magnificent structure. At least, however far they got with it, subsequent structures were rather impressive. And this was a religious, cultural, political center, with the top being the focal point of it all. Attention focused there. Okay, now with that in mind, and I'm going to summarize all this, and I know I'm leaving a few loose ends as I go along. I'll come back to that in a few minutes and try to put this together. So that's the tower. Let us build, they said. Well, they wanted strength. They thought they could come from unity. Secondly, they said they wanted to build a city. Well, that was the governmental rebellion against God. Thirdly, they wanted to build a tower. Well, that was the rebellion, spiritual rebellion. The establishment of a worship center, centralized, which became corrupted. Probably the beginnings of astrology, if not at that time, soon thereafter. Fourthly, make us a name. This is a manifestation of their own personal rebellion or pride. And finally, five, lest we be scattered. This is collectivism in defiance of God's command. Verse 5. And the Lord came down. How does that strike you? For some reason, that's always been a little humorous to me. The Lord came down. It's actually what is known technically as an anthropomorphic expression. God doesn't have to come down anywhere, technically, because he is what? omnipresent. But an anthropomorphic description of God's action and going to stop the action of men. It's just a very dramatic way of describing what God's doing. To see the city and the tower which the sons of men builded. Ha-avam used here, reminding us of man and what he's made out of, dirt. Which the children or sons of men have builded. They haven't completed it, but at least they've built it to this point. Verse 6, and the Lord said, behold, they're one people. They've entered into a collectivism. They all have the same language. I translated at this point, and this is what they begin to do. Or this is merely the beginning of what they do. I think that's an adequate translation of it. For nothing that they desire to do will they desist. The point is this, that God recognizes their defiance of his command to scatter and realizes the detrimental effects of centralization and is going to put a stop to it. Come, let us go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. They stopped building it. Therefore was the name of it called Babel. We got a little play on words here. Let's see it. Here's the word in the Hebrew, Babel. Looks like this. B-A, and it's pronounced with a soft B in Hebrew. It's Babel. And the word means, it comes from a verb. Well, I'll give you the verb. Because Jehovah did there, or the Lord did there, confound the language. And that is the verb, and it looks like this. It is Baal, B-A-L-A-L, Baal. So the idea is that the name of the place came to be called confusion. For there is where the Lord confused their language. Now, subsequent Babylonian history, they defined it in a different term. They did not want to call it Babel, confused, but subsequent Babylonian history reveals they called this place Babili. Looks like this. B-A-B-I-L-I. Babili, meaning gate of God. That was their own assessment of its significance. God's assessment of its significance, it is that what it was, Baal or Babel. It was a place of confusion. Now, from thence did Jehovah scatter them abroad upon the face and wished language of their heart. That's falling a little form. Human nature, I imagine, at first they got mad at one another. I mean, it's not my problem. The problem that you have is your problem. You don't understand me. I know what I'm saying. I think they understood what they were saying, but they did not understand what the other was saying. So what happens with the asphalt crew? Well, the asphalt crew, they throw down all their asphalt and they said, forget it. We can't do this. They're thinking probably. Now, I think the thought patterns were probably changed. The way they think, the way they put their words together. So the asphalt crew throws down its equipment, walks off the job. The brick crew throws down its equipment, walks off the job. And they begin to go off into groups. So this takes us then on to the second area. And that is the thought patterns which the languages expressed were changed. Language expresses thought, obviously. And the thought patterns were probably as well were adjusted. Thirdly, then, communication was disrupted. And as a result, when you have communication disruption, what happens immediately? Suspicion. Suspicion. And this suspicion then created, which came as a result, brought a sudden screeching halt to the whole building process. Now, there's something there for other areas of life, a little illustration or two about family. If you don't have communication in the family, what happens? building your family will come to a screeching halt, and you'll just start living in the same roof, under the same roof, but there will not be any significance spiritually. Communication is essential. And fourthly, these language changes became the basis for other language changes. These language changes became the basis for others. Today, there are 3,000 spoken languages, plus all kinds of dialects. Dialects would be the way a language is spoken in a local area, a local form of a language. Like in China, you have Chinese, but you have all kinds of dialects. So what happened is that you had at this moment the immediate creation of what is called parent languages. And we can divide the languages up into, well, any number of divisions, but the two major languages, if we were to use a circle and break it out like this, 49% of the world's language groups fall into what is known as Indo-European. This is our parent group, and we have in this language group, we have the what we know as the Romance languages, probably the European, Northern European, some of the Asiatic languages, and so forth. So you have this group. I'll come back to that when we get to the Table of Nations in Chapter 10. Then you have 23% come out into what is called the Sino-Tibetan language. This would be Chinese, Burmese, and so on. But what God did at the Tower of Babel was to create then these parent languages. And of course, out of that came other languages as they would go off into their own particular groups geographically. Languages changed. Then, five, language changes also resulted in the transformation of, and I had a question on this last week, so here's some help in your, for the one who asked the question. Language change also resulted in the transformation of the human race genetically, or helping us to answer the question, where did the racial characteristics come from? So what happened with the language change? This created the circumstances for genetic variations to demonstrate themselves. Geographic isolation created the circumstances for racial features to begin to become organized and dominate certain groups. It would not have happened as they stayed in one group, but as they moved out, it gave greater possibilities with the isolation and the limitation of the gene pool in geographical areas. So here you have the development of racial characteristics taking place at that time, or at least the beginning of it. Evolution would have you to believe that racial groups have been formed, their appearances, because of adaptation to environment. Like, or the animal kingdom is described that the giraffe has a long neck because it had to stretch to get its food, and such preposterous ways of trying to explain character difference in features. But these changed by virtue or because the language changed. Okay, now I need to do this. Let's summarize, and I need to make some application on this event at Babel. Let's spend a little time talking about the Tower of Babel. And, you know, Babylon becomes quite an important study in Scripture. We could have a whole series on Babylon. Easy. But I want to try to pull some things together for you now to help you understand the significance of the Babel experience in Genesis. All right, we need to say this, and this is our first observation. The motive for building this city and tower was sinful. That is what God dealt with, the motive. Building of a city is not sinful, but the motive behind their building the city was sinful. It was disobedience to the command to scatter. It was an attempt to collectivize in disobedience to the command to scatter and be distributed. This was an attempt. Could it not very well have been an attempt to do what? To Edenize their circumstances? By that I mean to create another Garden of Eden, a utopia, controlled environment. Let's get together and let's control and let's build our little kingdom on earth. I think so. That's just built into human nature. Where does it come from? I think it's built, it's part of human nature because God made us originally to enjoy a perfect environment and with the experience of Eden, and man just can't get it out of his system. But you know what the problem is? You know why you can't have an Eden? Because you've got this sin nature. And as long as the sin nature is in the picture and man's tendency to sin, you'll never have it. That is why we always look with a real raised eyebrow and skepticism at all attempts at talk of utopia in our world. And the humanist just can't learn it. See, we've got plenty of Nimrods around today. And those who attempt to build Babel. But it'll never come off. Oh, well, they'll almost, it'll look like they'll do it. Revelation 17 and 18, so there'll be an attempt to rebuild this Babel experience. So the tendency of man is toward collectivism. That is why socialism, as far as I'm concerned, is always a symptom of increased depravity and degeneration. You see, a nation kind of goes through cycles. It starts out with some concepts about a republic and the importance of laws and respect for freedoms. And then you'll see it go through a stage of so-called democracy. Our nation was never designed to be a democracy, but you find people think, oh, we're supposed to be a democracy. No such thing, never worked. Athens tried it. It was a big flop, trying to get everybody in to make decisions, and we'll just listen to the wisdom of the masses. And it just doesn't work. And so what happens when the democracy, if however long it lasts, and doesn't last, maybe a day or less, it then degenerates into a dictatorship of some sort, tyranny. Now, what we're in is that we're in some advanced stages of tyranny right at this point, because we've way past, as I've heard said, and we're just now living on the perfume of an empty vase in this matter of a republic and freedoms. The freedoms we enjoy and the fact that you and I can go home in safety and enjoy what freedoms we have is because of things in the past that have been established. Not because of any things that our politicians are brewing up for us now. Matter of fact, many are working overtime to destroy these. So you see this trend, and you see it originally here at Babel. Good illustration. Secondly, God judged the first attempt at internationalism. God judged the first attempt at internationalism, or the one world government concept. And it was actually an act of mercy. It was an act of mercy, because it helped preserve human freedom. You know what would have happened if he hadn't? They'd have lost every freedom they had. All you need is a few tyrants like Nimrod. And history is strewn with its Nimrods. And we've got Nimrods waiting in the wings right now. Don't you kid yourself for a minute. And they've got all the charisma. And all it takes is the right time, the right place, and enough public panic or enough public dismay and enough public desire for peace and prosperity at any cost. Protect us, lest we be scattered. Oh, if we don't hang together. And so we'll surrender our freedoms to one man. Usually it starts out with a group, but it boils down to one. We'll be willing to surrender our freedoms for the security of the promises and the strength of this one man. So therefore, it's an act of mercy. It helped to preserve human freedom through nationalism. And it prevented the human race from collectivism and rapid degeneration. Now, that's not to say that the human race has not spun off, and groups in the human race have spun off into nations and have created degeneration in their own nations. Obviously, this didn't stop that on a local basis. But by merely distributing the nations so that they can go out, and because of natural geographical boundaries, by oceans, by mountains, by deserts, by rivers, these things contributed to setting up national autonomous nations. That is at least a safety valve, but that's no guarantee, because all you got to do is look at some great socialistic diabolicals of Sweden. How about that one, for an example? That isn't a case of decadence and degeneracy. My apologies to all you who have roots in Sweden, and I'm sure they're fine Swedish people. But the climate in Sweden is absolute decadence. It's corrupt. Well, you know they got a law there now. You can't even spank your child. You've seen that. It's against the law to spank your child. And you can see these things traced through the apostasy of Sweden. They've had an apostate church for years, dead as a doornail. Trouble is, they're dead and don't know it in the churches, an apostate to the core. But that's socialism. Now, we've got some people waiting in the wings who would like to socialize this nation. You can be sure it's the socialism is the death row of any nation. You can be sure that a nation has lost its vigor, has lost its objectives in terms of biblical patterns when it starts talking in terms of socialism. You've lost your national vigor. It's this lest we scatter thing. Let's get together. And it's the unwillingness to face the future by trying to collectivize and surrender freedoms. That's what happened at Babel. Thirdly, God's answer to Babel came in a special way. God's answer to Babel came in a special way at Pentecost, Acts 2. Contrast these two, please, Acts 2 and Genesis 11. Because as he diversified the languages in Genesis, so he provides an experience of tongue speaking at Acts and to Pentecost to show the universal nature of the gospel. The gospel is for all tongues. Acts 2 contrasts with Genesis 11, where as he diversified the nations by languages Genesis 11, he demonstrated the universal nature of the gospel in Acts 2. That's our commission. The gospel is for every language-speaking group, every different kind of language. Fourthly, this event of Babel closes the third dispensation, which we know as the dispensation of human government. Because here's the failure of human government. This closes the dispensation of human government. The failure of human government. Human government is not the answer to man's problems. Never has been and never will be. Nationally or internationally, the White House, the president, I don't care who we get into office, that is not going to be the answer to national problems. But we're caught up in this. Right now, everybody's beating the drums about who's going to be the next president. They simply take turns to show how what failures one man or government is. And they all have neat little ways of coming up with showing how the previous man really was a failure, but I won't be. And we'll go through the same thing. We went through it with our present president. He was making all these promises. And we're going to have this great era of morality in government. And then right away, you take the lid off of a little bit of immorality here and there, not with the president himself, but some of the people he brought in around him. And I'm sure some people got quite cynical and are ready to switch over. Now we've got somebody else in the wings. I'm sure it's in both parties, but the Democrats think they've got somebody all shined up, waiting in the wings to come out, and he's going to say that the problem is not with the policies of our party, but the problem is that this man just hasn't worked those policies. So he'll come along and make all these promises, and guess what? He'll show his teeth if he runs, and he'll make all these promises. We'll go through the whole thing all over again. We're going to straighten it out. We're going to get it back. Peace, prosperity. You know, and you hear it all every day in the paper. And everybody get caught up. Hey, hey, hey. Look, give us this. We want peace. And do away with war. And do away with weapons. And give us more money. And all this. And defeat inflation. Yay. Bring another one in. He'll flop. Bring another one on. Human government fails. That's not to say that you shouldn't strike out to vote for a man who has some sense and someone who can try to bring order out of chaos and can establish some principles that will pull some things together. But do remember, human government is failure. It is nationally, it is internationally, because human government cannot resist the centralization of power and authority. This is why there must be restraints built into any nation's if it has any kind of constitution. That was the sense of our founding fathers. They knew the inherent tendency of man to corruption and the inherent tendency of man by his depravity to centralize and to control, to monopolize, and to destroy freedoms. They saw it, they realized it, they built the Constitution then with enough wording, and this is why we were established as a republic, not a democracy, a republic, so that we're a nation governed by laws to protect us from one another. We're under no illusions about what one another is. and that we need to be protected. We need to be protected from those who would get into positions of high office and use it for their own ends and to remove our freedoms in the name of freedom. So keep that in mind in terms of any government, but you have the example here, the first example of human government. Remember it, Genesis 11. Five, the Tower of Babel becomes the beginning of man's attempt. The Tower of Babel becomes the beginning of man's attempt to build an enduring kingdom on earth without God. This is why Babylon becomes representative from here on out in Scripture of what? False religion and centralized government in defiance of God. Scripture begins with this note, and how does it end? Revelation 17 and 18. Babylon, that great harlot. So then again, the Tower of Babel becomes the beginning of man's attempt to build an enduring kingdom on earth without God. Babylon becomes a representative of all false religion, of all kinds of satanic internationalism. The original Babylonian religious system serves as the source of the world's non-Christian religions. What happened at Babel? Probably something on this fashion. They attempted to first urbanize and decentralize their government, bring everybody in under one roof. But then very soon, it became a place, the motive demonstrated itself and some serious consequences, like false religion, trying to worship the creature rather than the Creator. Maybe I'll save that for a minute, and I'll show you how this probably worked out. But let me give a couple of other factors before I do that. 6, one day God will reverse the judgment of Genesis 11 and the diversification of languages, Zephaniah 3:9. One day God will reverse the judgment of Genesis 11 and the diversification of languages. I think one of the implications of Zephaniah 3:9 is that there will be a universal language in the millennial kingdom. We'll all speak the same tongue. See, right now this is a hindrance. It's a protection, but it's a hindrance. So when all Christians get together in the future, in the kingdom, and then out into eternity, we won't have to go around with an interpreter. Or else how else could you get through the Apostle Paul? I mean, he'd be speaking in Aramaic, or Hebrew, or Greek, or Latin. Now, Paul would be quiet to have a lot of facility, so here I come up speaking in Southernese. And I'm trying to talk with Paul. Now, he speaks four. I might could stumble along and throw out a Greek word here and there for him. If he starts speaking in Greek, I can't keep up with it. So I've got to go hustle over here and find an interpreter. No, we won't have to worry about that. God's going to reverse that, and he will take away that aspect of God, of his judgment, and we'll have this communication. I don't know what language it will be. I guess we have a tendency to think it'll be English, but could be a good case for Hebrew. So better get to work on your Hebrew. Well, maybe we get a jump. We're getting a jump on it. Get to work on your Hebrew. 7, Nimrod became the leader of the Babel kingdom. Nimrod became the leader of the Babel kingdom. It looks like I won't get to talk about Nimrod much. I had a few things I wanted to say about this tyrant. But we'll get him next week. But he was a strong leader. And he helped to organize and motivate a strongly centralized society. I think he's probably a very brilliant leader. Very powerful, but behind the scenes, this was an invisible satanic conspiracy. And now 8, the tower itself was to be a cultural, political, and religious center of the world. I should say the tower itself was to be the cultural, political, and religious center of the world. This temple tower was probably erected to be an aid to worship, probably under some kind of guise of an altar where men could bring their sacrifices and worship God. Sure, probably something like that. Who could have objected to such a nice objective? We're going to bring a place so that we can all come and we can see the sacrifice offered way up here, this place representing heaven, up in the sky. And we'll all meet, and it'll be a moving experience. But this is what happened. Probably, and you get here some rehash of Genesis of Romans 1, but it could very well have been like this. This is the way apostasy often works. All right, first of all, you get this old line, aid to worship. You get all these trinkets and doodads as aids to worship. Something along the line of a great deal of emphasis on beauty and ornateness. Help us to worship. Now, there's nothing wrong with beauty and ornateness, but it's not going to help you to worship. I mean, a stained glass window is not going to make you sing holy, holy, holy any better than a, well, those shades are a little crooked back there. I'm not, I don't want to justify that, but it's not going to make any difference. What's up behind me here? One of these. Well, they're all right. But it doesn't make any difference whether it's a stained glass window or not. Are you going to worship God more if you've got some the light rushing through the different colors and that kind of thing? But this is the way it will often start. I think this is probably the way it began at Babel. Then this. Then very soon, the creature comes in to substitute for the Creator. How? Probably the sacrifices that they brought easily become not the sacrifice as a means to an end, but perhaps an end in itself. Animals are a model or a painting is structured. Something that symbolizes, maybe like a lion, strength and majesty. Something to symbolize a certain aspect of creation, with perhaps the rationalization being, this helps us to look at God's majesty. Something along that line. Then very soon, of course, these original worshipers are aware of angelic host, and they can look at the sky, and they think that, well, perhaps an aid to worship, well, let's, what about the angels? What about spirits? They make association between the spirits and between the stars. So by various means, they start bringing the creation in as a substitute for the Creator. Then what happens? Then, with all of this complex situation developing, the special things you've got to do, the special meaning to the symbols, and all of that, and the special times you must meet and do it the right way, then there comes the demand, because of a complicated ritual system, the demand for priest. Representatives and or priestesses. Well, of course, Satan is working in this thing like a termite. He's working from the beginning, because you see what he's going to do, infiltrate this with demonism under the guise of angels. He will work through demon-possessed priests and priestesses. Eventually in this thing, see, they will then offer human sacrifice, like the Carthaginians were doing when the Romans destroyed them. That's one of the reasons that the Phoenicians, or the Carthaginians, who were Phoenicians, who were Canaanites, were destroyed, is that they were a decadent people. They were like a cancer. And what do you do with a malignant tumor? You try to get it out before it spreads. And this is the way the Phoenicians were, the Canaanites were, with their child sacrifice, bringing infants and putting them in the hands of Moloch, this replica of a bull, and with its hands out like this, and bring babies, live babies now, and place them in these hands, and they're rolled down into the fire, and the babies are burned. That's what the Carthaginians were doing to worship. Yeah, we hear people talk about, well, they're just worshiping in their own way. What right did God have to have the Israelites go in and destroy these people, or the Japhethites, the Romans, destroy these people? Because they were malignant cancer. They were mad dogs. That's what they were. That's what you do to mad dogs. They're dangerous. And this is how it degenerated, with these demon possession. And so Babel then becomes the prototype for all false religion. Now, this is the beginning of a study which could be made, which I can only suggest to you now. And it seems that all religions, you just think about this, a little food for thought. All subsequent false religion finds this as its fountainhead. All false religion finds this experience as its fountainhead. Because as the people were spread out through the earth, They carried with them the concept of sacrifice. They carried with them the concept of priests and priestesses. They carried with them, the use of demon possession. And so you can see this work its way into other cultures in terms of human sacrifice, priests and priestesses, and astrology, and all kinds of things of that nature. And you will find a mother image in the Godhead, perhaps after Semiramis, Nimrod's wife, the mother queen who gives birth to a child. And you get all kinds of development that come out of this that forms the pattern for whether it's Ashtarte, or whether it's Isis in Egypt, or Ashtarte, the Baalim in Canaan, you can see it. Or whether it's Cupid in Roman culture. So you just can take it to all the cultures and see how it flowed out of this original beginning, apostasy at Babel. Now what we've done is, of course, taken the 11th chapter before the 10th, and we need to go back to the 10th chapter. Now see how the nations worked out, were distributed. And I'm not going to overstay my welcome, so I'm going to stop, and we'll pick that up. And that'll be an easy thing to do, because from 10, we can go right on over then to chapter 11 and verse 10, the continuation of the genealogy, and go to Abraham himself. Let's close in prayer. Father, may we profit by what we've studied to be more alert, our Lord, to tendencies to think in terms of human pride, remembering the nature of sin, which is the aspiration for independence from you. Lord, we need you. We need you because of this sin nature that roars within us, but yet is like a sleeping snake. We need your Spirit to subdue and to control, to form Christ in us. Accomplish that in a greater measure this week. In the name of our Lord, that's asked. Amen.